Yes. Okay, so title is Derived Algebraic Geometry, and I think that I submitted sort of a plan for what's going to happen during these lectures, but I don't remember what is on the plan, so I made another plan, but I'm not wedded to this plan. So the first thing that I want to say is I don't really know you all, and I don't know what you know and what you want to know, so my plan for this course is very flexible. So if you have any suggestions or things you'd like to hear about, offer them up, and I'm happy to steer things in that direction. But there are no suggestions for today, so I'll start out. According to plan, I'd like to give sort of an introduction motivating derived algebraic geometry, both from the point of view of algebraic geometry and algebraic topology. So to start out, I'd like to motivate derived algebraic geometry from the point of view of algebraic geometry. So I'd like to begin with something very classical, namely Bayes' theorem. Let me remind you, Bayes' theorem is about algebraic curves in the projective plane. So if C and C prime are two smooth curves having degrees m and n, respectively, and if C and C prime meet transversely, then the number of intersection points of C and C prime is precisely the product of their degrees, n times m. So this is the classical statement of Bayes' theorem in the simplest case, where C and C prime meet transversely. You can also phrase this a little bit more canonically in the language of cohomology. This is really an equation which is taking place inside the cohomology ring of CP2. Namely, C and C prime are oriented submanifolds of CP2, and therefore they have fundamental classes, which live, say, in the cohomology of CP2. Which is just isomorphic to the integers. And these degrees, m and n, are more or less, by definition, what these fundamental classes correspond to under this isomorphism with the integers. And now this product, n times m, that's really the cup product of the fundamental class of C with the fundamental class of C prime, which now lives in H4 of CP2 with coefficients in Z. This is again isomorphic to the integers. Under that isomorphism, this product just corresponds to n times m. And this equation is telling you that that product, n times m, is supposed to be the number of points of intersection, or in other words, the fundamental class of the intersection. C and C prime are meeting transversely. The intersection of C and C prime is a zero-dimensional submanifold of CP2, and it also has a fundamental class. And so what Bayes' theorem is telling you is you have this equation of fundamental classes, and from this point of view, it's sort of obvious that this is supposed to be true. The fundamental class of the intersection is the cup product of the fundamental classes. Well, that's precisely what the cup product is designed to encode, intersections. But maybe it's not quite so obvious, because it's not necessarily true. It's true when C and C prime meet transversely, but if they meet non-transversely, then it's always false. So if it's a non-transverse intersection, then the number of points in the intersection is always strictly less than n times m. And the reason is easy to understand. This product, n times m, it's counting the number of points, but it's counting the number of points with multiplicity. And the multiplicity of a point of intersection is 1 precisely when the intersection is transverse at that point, and otherwise it's always strictly larger than 1. So instead, we have an equation, n times m is equal to a sum over intersection points of an intersection multiplicity of C and C prime at that point of intersection. And now, this is, of course, a formula which doesn't mean anything unless I define for you these intersection multiplicities. Well, let's suppose that C is given by an equation F equals 0, and that C prime is given by defining equation G equal to 0. Well, then the intersection multiplicity at P of C and C prime can be obtained by taking the ring of functions of the projective plane at this point and then dividing out by the functions F and G. Well, this is what you obtain is going to be a finite dimensional vector space over the complex numbers, and you're just supposed to take the dimension of that vector space. So there's some recipe for cooking up an intersection multiplicity, and the product n times m is the sum of those intersection multiplicities. That's how you salvage Bayes' theorem in the case of a non-transverse intersection. Now, what about this formula here? The intersection of C and C prime being compared with the cup product of the fundamental classes of C and C prime individually. Well, this is false on the face of it. The intersection of C and C prime is finitely many points, and if you just think about that as a finite subset and take its fundamental class in the usual sense, then, of course, this is just going to be some number which is smaller than n times m. However, if you think about things in a more sophisticated way, if you think not about this intersection as a variety or as a set, but you instead think of it, this intersection in the sense of schemes, then there's a sense in which this formula still holds. Namely, when you think about the scheme theoretic intersection of C and C prime, well, that precisely means that you are keeping track not only of what the points where C and C prime intersect, but you're keeping track of the rings of functions at those points. And those rings of functions are precisely these rings here that you get by taking the ring of functions on the projective plane and dividing out by the defining equations of C and C prime. So if we think about this scheme theoretic intersection, it knows not only what point the points of intersection are, but it knows about these rings. And therefore, we can extract these intersection multiplicities from the scheme theoretic intersection. So this formula, this is true if the left-hand side is properly interpreted. So properly interpreted means you have to form the intersection in the sense of schemes, and when you extract the fundamental class, you have to use the scheme structure and not just think of this as a submanifold of CP2. Okay, so now I'd like to think about a more complicated case of Bayes' theorem. Now let's assume not that we're talking about curves in the complex plane, but let's say we're talking about complex projective space of dimension D. So C and C prime, let's not assume that they're curves, but they're, say, smooth subvarieties. They still have degrees, and now they have dimensions. Let's say C is of dimension A, and C prime is of dimension B. And let's suppose that A plus B is equal to the ambient dimension D, so they're of complementary dimension. We expect them to intersect in finitely many points. So then, as before, if C and C prime meet transversely, then the number of points of intersection is finite, and it's precisely what you would expect. It's the product n times m. But if C and C prime meet non-transversely, things get a little bit more complicated. So if C and C prime don't meet transversely, but they still meet properly, that is, they meet in the expected dimension 0 in finitely many points, then the product n times m is not the number of intersection points, but the number of intersection points counted with multiplicity. It's the sum over points of intersection again, of some kind of intersection multiplicity of C and C prime at the points P, but the intersection multiplicity is a little bit more complicated in this case. So it's given by Serre's intersection formula. So according to Serre, the proper way to compute the intersection multiplicity of these subvarieties is to take an alternating sum of complex dimensions of certain core groups. Namely, you want to take the local ring of the two subvarieties and tore them together as modules over the local ring of the ambient variety in which you're forming the intersection. All right, so what is this saying? So this is a sum of many terms, and the most interesting term is the term that you get when I is equal to 0. So in that case, this tor group is just a tensor product. So what you're doing is taking the ring of functions on projective space and dividing out simultaneously by the equations that define C and the equations that define C prime. So what you obtain is the local ring of the scheme theoretic intersection. That's what we saw in the two-dimensional case. We just took the dimension of this ring, which is the tor zero term over there. Now in two dimensions, these higher tor I terms automatically vanish. But in higher dimensions, they don't automatically vanish, and according to Serre, they should contribute to this intersection multiplicity. So if you want to get the right number on the left-hand side, n times m, then you have to take into account all of these higher tor terms as well. Okay, so we have a formula like this, but now what happens if we try and write this down in the language of cohomology again? Well, we've already seen that if we want something like this to be true, it's not enough to think of C intersect C prime as a set, because that set might have the wrong number of elements. In the two-dimensional case, we could save the situation by thinking of C intersect C prime as a scheme. That way, we know about this ring, this tor zero term here, and we can extract the intersection multiplicity. But in the higher dimensional case, the intersection multiplicity is not determined by the scheme theoretic intersection. The scheme theoretic intersection only knows about this ring. It knows about this tor zero term here. But there are several other contributions to the intersection multiplicity, and these are not determined by the intersection of C and C prime in the world of schemes. So we want this to be true. But we need a more sophisticated notion of intersection in order to have a formula like this. So derived algebraic geometry is going to give us exactly this sort of a thing. It's going to give us a more sophisticated notion of what it means to intersect two subvarieties, and it will enable us to make a statement like this in higher dimensions, not assuming that C and C prime meet transversely. Okay, so where should we look for a formalism which will sort of have this property? So to answer that question, I'd like to go back and think about Bayes' theorem in an even simpler case. So let's go back to the two-dimensional case. And let's assume that C and C prime are actually of degree 1. The simplest case of all. They're just lines in the projective plane. Well, nothing can be simpler than that, because if I give you two lines in the complex projective plane, they always intersect transversely in exactly one point. Except in one very special situation. What if the two lines are actually equal to one another? Well, if we intersect a line with itself, of course we don't get just one point of intersection. We get a whole line of intersection. The intersection is the wrong dimension, and it doesn't even make sense to ask how many points there are. But we would like to say that in some sense, the intersection of a line with itself, well, maybe, you know, physically it's there are infinitely many points there, but we would like our formalism, a formula like this, to be true in our formalism in general. So that intersection, we would like to say, knows that it should have dimension zero and that it should contain exactly one point. So how are we going to cook up a formalism like that? Well, let's think about what's going on here in coordinates. And to simplify matters, I'm going to think not about the projective plane, but about just the ordinary affine plane. So now, in the ordinary affine plane, two distinct lines which intersect, without loss of generality, they're given by equations x equals 0 and y equals 0. And now if we want to form the intersection, C intersect C prime, that's going to be the spectrum of a ring. And that ring we get by taking the ring of functions on the entire plane, that's a polynomial ring on two variables, x and y, and then dividing out by the defining equations of the two lines, which are x and y. And the result is that this ring of functions is just the complex numbers, and its spectrum is just one point. That's the point of intersection. So this is what we expect to happen. We have two variables and two equations, and we expect then finitely many solutions. All right, but what happens if C equals C prime? So now let's suppose that we're in the plane and that C and C prime are the same line, both given by the equation y equals 0. Well, then C intersect C prime in the world of schemes is supposed to be spec of the polynomial ring on x and y, and we're supposed to divide out by the equation of C and the equation of C prime. So again, we have two variables and two equations, but this ring is not finite dimensional over the complex numbers. We have infinitely many solutions. And the reason is these two equations are not independent of one another. It's really the same equation twice. And now, in commutative algebra, if you take a ring and you divide out by the same element twice, well, it doesn't matter whether you divide out by it twice or divide out by it once. So in order to obtain a reasonable answer, something that in some sense knows it should be zero-dimensional, we need this intersection to somehow know that we've imposed this equation y equals 0 twice rather than once. So that's what we would like to do. All right, so we're looking for, therefore, a notion of commutative ring where it makes sense to divide out by elements multiple times. So to simplify matters, let's forget that we're looking for some notion of commutative ring and think about something that might have that feature just in the world of sets. So suppose that I give you some set, which I'm going to draw on the board as a bunch of dots. And suppose that we have two elements of that set, which I'll call x and y. And suppose we would like to identify x with y. Well, we can do that. We just make a new set by where we collapse these two elements into one. But now I would like to think about the same construction in a different way. So let's be algebraic topologists for a moment. Suppose that someone gives us this set and we want to identify x with y. Well, we're going to think about this set as a discrete topological space. And now to identify x with y, rather than making a smaller space by crunching them together, I'd like to make a larger space by adjoining a path from x to y. Now, the result is, in some sense, the same as the result of just crunching x and y together. That is, it's a different space, but it's homotopy equivalent to the space where x and y just get identified because this interval is contractible. We could replace it by a point. On the other hand, this construction is a little bit nicer because it can be meaningfully iterated. That is, if we want to set x equal to y not once but twice, we can adjoin two paths from x to y. And once we have two paths from x to y, we get something new. We get something which is not equivalent to a discrete space, because two paths from x to y gives a non-trivial loop from x to itself. This space is not homotopy equivalent to a discrete space because it has non-trivial fundamental group. And similarly, if I wanted to identify x with y not twice, but say five times, well, this space now has a pretty complicated fundamental group, and the size of that fundamental group is somehow measuring the number of times that we've identified x with y. So this is one way that you can think of algebraic topology. It's sort of like set theory, but sensitive to redundant information. All right, so the moral of this is that working with topological spaces is a way of building a formalism which is sensitive to, say, how many times you identify two points. Now, we would like to do this, but instead of doing this just with ordinary sets, we would like some analog where we work with commutative rings instead, because we would like to do algebraic geometry with it. So now we have several options. So to proceed, we want a formalism that, that behaves, or let me say, we want objects that behave like topological spaces and like commutative rings. And there are several options for that you might consider for what such a formalism could be. So this is we could think of this like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. So option number one, Papa Bear's option, is to just mix these in the most naive possible way. Consider topological commutative rings. That is, commutative rings equipped with a topology for which the ring operations are continuous. Now, this leads to a good theory, and it's actually a good theory which is very suitable for building the kind of formalism that I was talking about here, but it's going to be unsuitable for talking about a lot of the things that I would like to talk about later in this course. And the reason is this is going to be too restrictive for many applications. So this, we might complain, is sort of too strict. So what do I mean by that? Well, why are we introducing these topological spaces? The role that they're going to play, we really only care about their homotopy types. That is, we don't care about the topological spaces themselves. They're only a mechanism for talking about points and paths between points and homotopies between paths and so on. And therefore, sort of any equation that holds up to homotopy should be regarded really just as good as an equation which holds on the nose. So there are going to be many examples that we'll encounter of spaces X such that X has, say, an addition and a multiplication satisfying the ring axioms, but only up to homotopy. And in many cases, you have interesting examples of such spaces X which cannot be sort of straightened out. They're not equivalent to spaces which have an addition and multiplication that satisfy ring axioms on the nose. So Papa Bear is too strict. Another suggestion would be to loosen this up and that's to consider commutative ring objects in the homotopy category. This is like the mama bear option. That is, topological spaces equipped with an addition and multiplication which exactly satisfy all of the commutative ring axioms in the homotopy category of topological spaces. All of the axioms hold up to homotopy. But this is not strict enough. And what I mean by this is, well, if everything just holds up to unspecified homotopy, it's really, you can't really get a good theory off the ground here. You would like to work with objects where you have a good analog of the theory of commutative algebra. You'd like to have not only rings, but also a theory of modules and so on, and analogs of all of the usual constructions, and this setting is just sort of too lax in order to have such a theory. So there's a final possibility, which is sort of a middle ground between the two. Option number three is to work with what are called E-infinity ring spectra, or I'll sometimes just call them E-infinity rings. So an E-infinity ring spectrum, well, I'll say in more detail what sort of a thing it is next time, but roughly speaking, you should think of it as a topological space equipped with a ring structure, but where the ring axioms are not required to hold on the nose, only up to homotopy, but the homotopies are not arbitrary, they're also part of the data, and they also have to satisfy their own axioms, their own coherence conditions. So maybe this should be said, these are rings up to coherent homotopy. So this is sort of an intermediate between option one and option two, and it's just right for many purposes. That is, there's enough structure that you can actually build a theory here, but there's not so much structure that you rule out the interesting examples. Okay, so I'm not going to say anything else about the notion of an E-infinity ring spectrum today. If you like, let's stick with option number one for the rest of this lecture. All right, so say we're working with topological commutative rings. What sorts of topological commutative rings do we want to consider? So one thing that I've already mentioned is that when we work with these topologies, we don't really care so much about the underlying topological spaces. They're only mechanisms for carrying around homotopy groups. So in particular, if we have a map which is a weak homotopy equivalence, that is, the induced map on homotopy groups, is an isomorphism, then F we should think of as morally invertible. For all practical purposes, F is identifying A with B, and A and B should be thought of as the same ring. So an upshot of this is that most of the topological commutative rings you may be familiar with are not very interesting from this point of view. So for example, if you have a topological commutative ring which is a topological vector space over the real numbers, the sort of thing that might come out of functional analysis, well, then it's contractible as a topological space, and so it's equivalent for us to the zero ring. On the other hand, if you have a topological commutative ring that sort of comes out of algebra, something like, you know, the p-adic integers or some completion of some ring with respect to an ideal, something like that, well, those topological spaces are totally disconnected, and they have no non-trivial homotopy groups above zero. So those topological rings might as well be discrete from our point of view. We're not really interested in those kinds of topologies either. So what kinds of topologies are interesting for us? what kinds of rings do arise? Well, typically, the kinds of rings that we would be interested in are the ones that arise from the kind of construction that I was describing earlier. That is, let's suppose that we start with some discrete commutative ring R, which is drawn on the board as a bunch of dots, and suppose we have two elements, X and Y, in R. And suppose we want to identify X with Y, but we want to do it in the sort of subtle way that I was indicating earlier. We don't collapse anything, but instead we adjoin a path between X and Y. Well, in the case where these were just sets, we could just adjoin a single path. But if we want the result to have a ring structure, things are going to get a lot more complicated. We can't just adjoin a single path from X to Y. We also have to adjoin lots of other points. So, for example, we can take the midpoint of this path, and we also have to adjoin to our ring other things like, you know, M cubed plus Z, where Z is some other element of our ring. Or, well, you can imagine many, many variations on this. So the upshot of this is that adjoining this one path makes the space much, much more complicated. It results in lots of other paths getting drawn. So there's a picture of it. It's just really a big mess, and it's not something that you should try and visualize directly. But you shouldn't be discouraged by the fact that this is a big mess, because even though it's maybe not something that's so easy to get a picture of, it does have reasonable algebraic topology invariance. That is, you can compute the homotopy groups of this resulting space fairly easily. So, let me just tell you the result of that calculation. So let R be a discrete ring. And suppose that Y is an element of R. And suppose that I consider R modulo Y. But when I say R modulo Y, I mean this in the sort of topological sense that I was talking about a second ago. That is, I'm not going to make a smaller ring, but I'm going to make a larger ring in which I've adjoined freely a path that joins 0 to y. So this is a big mess, but you can nonetheless compute its homotopy groups. So the zeroth homotopy group is just what you think you get. Namely, it's what you get by taking the discrete ring R and modding out by y in the usual sense. So this is the co-kernel of the multiplication by Y map from R to R. I is equal to 0. Well, if I is equal to 1, it turns out that you just get the kernel of the multiplication by Y map from R to R. And otherwise, all the higher homotopy groups turn out to be 0. So even though this looks like a very complicated space, it has reasonably simple homotopy groups. And now I would just like to rename these a little bit. These groups up here can be identified with the Tor groups over the ring Z bracket Y of Z with the ring R. That is, R is a Z bracket Y module by the map Y goes to this particular element Y, and Z is a Z brackets module Y module by identifying Y with 0. So Tor 0 term, well, I'm tensoring them together. That means I'm taking R and I'm dividing out by Y. And these higher Tor terms, well, they're precisely the homotopy groups of the topological ring that I get by doing this construction I mentioned earlier. So what's the upshot of this discussion? It's that this formalism of topological rings, not only does it seem vaguely like it might capture the right kind of information, it's actually capturing exactly the sort of information that appeared in Serre's intersection formula. Is Serre's intersection formula still somewhere? Yes. So Serre's intersection formula tells us that if we want to compute the right intersection multiplicities for two subvarieties of a projective space, then we have to count the dimensions of some Tor groups. And this, or a slightly more general version of this calculation, tells you that those Tor groups are actually the homotopy groups of a certain topological ring that I would get by a sort of topological version of this tensor product construction. So working with topological commutative rings, it looks like it might capture the right kind of information. So now I'd like to just summarize this discussion and mention that it does. So, idea work with topological commutative rings instead of discrete rings, and result that you get a formula, a version of this Bayes' theorem, namely the fundamental class of the intersection of C and C prime is the cup product of the fundamental classes, and this holds with no restriction on transverse intersections. That is, C and C prime don't have to intersect transversely. They don't even have to intersect in the right dimension. However, this intersection has to be formed in the appropriate world, that is, it needs to be formed in the world of algebraic geometry based on topological commutative rings rather than discrete commutative rings, and the fundamental class of the intersection has to somehow use that information. It's the so-called virtual fundamental class. Okay, so this is one, say, motivation for the ideas of derived algebraic geometry, and it's not one that I'm going to follow any further in this course. So this is sort of an algebra geometric motivation for introducing algebraic geometry based on topological rings rather than ordinary commutative rings. Now what I'd like to change gears a little bit and talk about motivations that come from algebraic topology itself. Motivations from algebraic topology. All right, so suppose you're an algebraic topologist. One of your jobs is to compute things. That is, you have all kinds of interesting spaces that you might want to look at, like classifying spaces of groups, Eilenberg-MacLane spaces, various other things that homotopy theorists know how to cook up. And you have all kinds of invariants that you can consider of those spaces, like homology groups, cohomology groups, K-theory, and your job is to compute some of those invariants for some of those interesting spaces. Now, before you can start attacking a question like that, you have to ask, what kind of answer do you want to get? So, for example, if you were interested in computing the cohomology of a space X with coefficients in a field K, well, the answer is going to be a vector space over the field K. And one form that in which you might give that answer is by writing down a basis of that vector space. But typically, the answers to your questions have a lot more structure than just that of a vector space. So, for example, in this case, the cohomology actually, this is a K-algebra. It's a ring with a map from K. And if we ignore issues about the grading, it's even a commutative K-algebra. It's a graded commutative. So one form which your answer might take instead of writing down a basis, you could try and write down some kind of presentation of this as a K-algebra, say by generators and relations. Now, if you're an algebraic geometer and someone hands you a commutative algebra over a field K, then your immediate instinct should be to try and interpret that commutative algebra as the ring of functions on some space, like some algebraic variety defined over K. So that suggests another answer that this question might take, form that your answer might take. Instead of trying to describe this as a commutative ring, you could just try and describe it. Think of that commutative ring as the ring of functions on some space and describe the space. In other words, try to describe the spectrum of the cohomology of X with coefficients in K as some kind of algebraic variety over K. So this might seem like sort of a weird thing to do, but it has turned out to be a surprisingly useful way of organizing the results of calculations and thinking about them conceptually. So I'd like to start by giving an example. So let's script A to note the mod 2 steam rod algebra. So this is the algebra of stable operations on the cohomology mod 2 of spaces. So this algebra of operations was computed by, I guess you would say it's computed by Serre, although you can correct me if that's not quite accurate. It looks like it's generated as an algebra over the field with two elements by these Steenrod operations, square 1, square 2, square 3, and so on, and these are subject to a bunch of relations. And I'm not going to write down what the relations are because I don't remember what they are, and they're a little bit complicated. So what I would like to do instead is to describe this in a different way, a way which I can remember. So the Steenrod algebra arises because it acts on the cohomology of spaces. So for all x, there's an action of the Steenrod algebra on the cohomology of x with coefficients in the field with two elements mapping to h star of x with coefficients in the field with two elements. And now, modulo finiteness, I can turn this around and say this is a map from x, cohomology of x with coefficients mod 2 to the cohomology of x with coefficients mod 2 tensored with the dual of the Steenrod algebra. All right, now I want to consider a special case where x is the classifying space of the group Z mod 2. In that case, this cohomology ring, this just looks like a power series ring on one generator T. Here T lives in H1 of X with coefficients in F2. Whether I call this a polynomial ring or a power series ring depends on what my convention is for converting graded rings into ordinary rings. Do I take the product of all the graded pieces or the sum of all the graded pieces? I'm going to take the product of all the graded pieces. And now what is this ring? This is the ring of functions on the formal additive group. GA. That is, you can think about this as a coordinate on an affine space, but it's a formal affine space because I'm considering power series in T. If I want to be able to evaluate power series in T, T has to be very small. So this turns out to be the ring of functions on the formal additive group. And now, this here is a ring homomorphism that I've written down there. So what you actually get is a map from spec of the dual Steenrod algebra tensored with, crossed with the formal spectrum of F2 power series T into the formal spectrum of F2 adjoint power series generator T. So in other words, this is a map from the spectrum of the dual Steenrod algebra crossed with the formal additive group into the formal additive group. Well, this gives me a map from the spec of the dual Steenrod algebra into the automorphism group of the formal additive group. And this map turns out to be an isomorphism. So this is another way of sort of expressing or calculating what the algebra of stable operations on cohomology looks like. That is, we know that there's some algebra which fits the bill. One thing that we can do is actually compute, try and present that algebra by generators and relations. That's the first thing I started to write down. But another form that the answer might take is by writing down some, in this case, scheme that we can build out of the Steenrod algebra and then characterizing that scheme by a universal property. In this case, the scheme is characterized by the fact that it acts on the formal additive group and, well, it's universal among things which act on the formal additive group. So now we get two different descriptions of the mod 2 Steenrod algebra, and in theory, you could pass between these two descriptions purely algebraically. That is, to get from this description to the presentation by Steenrod squares and the ADEM relations, well, what you need to do is understand what this automorphism group of the formal additive group looks like, write down some coordinates on it, and then write down, you know, how those coordinates behave, what the Hopf algebra structure is on that ring, and so forth. So in theory, that's a purely algebraic problem. In practice, it might be a little bit difficult, but at least it's purely algebraic. We don't have to know anything about topology to pass between these two descriptions. And this description here, at least for me, is much easier to remember than a presentation by generators and relations. Okay, so the upshot of this discussion is it can be useful to think about things algebra-geometrically. It can lead to some ways of conceptualizing the results of calculations. So now I'd like to tell a story with a slightly different moral. So another of our goals as algebraic topologists is to compute invariants of spaces and then sort of figure out what those invariants are telling us about the spaces. So if X is a topological space, one of the most interesting invariants is, of course, its cohomology. And why don't I consider its cohomology with coefficients in the integer z? So this is an invariant of x, and we can use it to get information about x. But this invariant is really a crude approximation to a better invariant. That is, if I consider the nth cohomology group of x with coefficients in z, well, this is really the minus nth homotopy group of a certain spectrum, namely the spectrum that I get by taking the Eilenberg-Maclane spectrum, Hz, and then taking the function spectrum of maps from x into that. So the cohomology of x is, that's really, cohomology groups are really the homotopy groups of a certain spectrum. And in fact, the ring structure on the cohomology groups of X results from a ring structure that exists on this spectrum itself. So this is an example of an E-infinity ring spectrum. And in some sense, this E-infinity ring spectrum is a much better invariant of X than just its homotopy groups individually. So one illustration of this is a theorem which I think is due to Mandel, which is that if X is, say, simply connected and its homology groups are of finite type, then this function spectrum as an E-infinity ring spectrum determines X up to homotopy equivalence. So cohomology is a good invariant of X. Classically, it can give us various pieces of information about X, but if we think about cohomology as in a more fundamental way, think about the cohomology spectrum rather than the individual cohomology groups, and think about that as a ring in a sophisticated way, as an E-infinity ring spectrum, then we've actually essentially remembered everything about X. So it's a very powerful invariant. Okay, so the moral of story number one is that results of calculations in algebraic topology, it can be useful to think about them geometrically. And the moral of story number two is that passing to homotopy groups in algebraic topology destroys a lot of information. That is, these cohomology groups are the homotopy groups of something with a lot of information, and when we just remember the groups, we've lost that information. So in some sense, what I'd like to do with this course is to combine those two lessons. That is, I would like to work with the sorts of objects that I got not by passing to homotopy, but things like E-infinity ring spectra themselves, and I would like to think about them in a geometric way. And the language that will allow me to do this is this language of derived algebraic geometry that I've been talking about earlier in this lecture. That is, the language for talking about things like schemes and algebraic stacks and so forth that are built not out of ordinary commutative rings, but out of things like these E-infinity ring spectra. Okay, so that is the plan for these 2 weeks. So now let me just end by sort of outlining my suggestion for how this course might go. And as I mentioned at the beginning, this is I'm very open to amending this plan if people would like to hear about something different. Okay. So the plan. So this Wednesday, I'll talk about this notion of an E-infinity ring spectrum and how you can sort of glue them together to make things like schemes. That is, I'll talk about these sort of basic ingredients of derived algebraic geometry. So now on Friday, in order to carry out this discussion, I'm going to sort of slough over some points about the sorts of objects that these E-infinity ring spectra actually are. So in the real language for talking about these things is a higher categorical language. That is, things like E-infinity ring spectra and derived schemes, they don't form an ordinary category, but they form something like a topological category or a higher category. So on Friday, I thought I might say a few words about higher category theory. So I know that Andre gave a course on higher category theory a few months ago, and some of you might have been around for that, but surely probably most of you weren't, so I'll say a few words about it nonetheless. So the following Monday, I would like to give some applications of this theory of derived schemes or derived group schemes to building equivariant cohomology theories. So this is something that I said something about in the talk that I gave at the conference 2 weeks ago. Then on Wednesday, I'd like to talk something about Artin's representability theorem in this context. So Artin's representability theorem addresses the question of, well, suppose I give you a description of some geometric object in terms of the functor that it's supposed to represent. That is, what is my geometric object supposed to do? And then it's a criterion on the functor that it represents that guarantees that there is a geometric object which does that. And finally, on Friday, I would like to apply Artin's theorem and use it to build elliptic cohomology. And on Monday, I'll say something about what elliptic cohomology is. All right, so that's all I have for today, unless somebody has some questions. Thank you.